Today's podcast a little bit different. It's not really about Celtic. It is about a working class sport, but it's not even about football. It's about rugby league. So if you have zero interest in it, switch off and wait for the 9-in-a-row Chronicles, which will be out tomorrow. However, if you are looking for a sport on the television, then the NRL in Australia kicks off this weekend. And if you know a bit about it, this will probably be of interest to you. If you just are aware that rugby league exists and don't really know what the difference between rugby union and rugby league is, this is a podcast for you. If you just like your wider sport, are aware of rugby league and not really sure what difference between that and rugby union is, this is a podcast for you. And if you want to know a bit about one of the things I always often reference on this podcast, the fact that rugby league is very similar to Scottish football in terms of its finances, etc. And this podcast touches on that, but we're going to do one in more detail. I think if you compare rugby league and Scottish football and take out Celtic and Rangers, then average attendances are about 200 apart or something like that. Anyway, there's more explained on the podcast. Speak to you later. This is me with Mike Michal Wood. So, this is the Celtic Underground podcast, but we're allowed to talk about whatever I want on here. So, this week, if you are desperately looking for sport, there is sports taking place down under in Australia this week, and I thought we'd do a podcast that would allow those of you just looking for any sport or might have a slight interest in this sport to get a wee bit more background on it. So I'm going to give a wee potted history of me. You might have seen me do the odd tweet about rugby league. All my relatives are from Cumbria, the west of Cumbria, so they're all from round about Whitehaven, Cleetamore, round there. Anybody listening, I'll go into great detail and say that one of my uncles and grandparents used to live up Branstay, so even more detail. But interestingly, they didn't follow Whitehaven rugby league team, they followed Workington rugby league. They are Workington Man that was so famous in the news. So I have always had a liking and an interest in rugby league. I had a fallout with St. Anthony on WhatsApp this week when he showed me some quiz questions and one that he was going to be creating for a family quiz. And one of the quiz questions was, who has won the Rugby World Cup 3 times? And I said, well, Australia have won it 11 times because the first Rugby World Cup was the Rugby League World Cup and the Rugby Union World Cup only started later, and actually there is no such thing as the Rugby World Cup. There is the Rugby League World Cup and the Rugby Union World Cup, and that's the type of thing that parents like me bug me. So I decided I would get an expert onto the podcast to talk about that. So we are going to give you a potted history of Rugby League and why Rugby League should matter to you if you're into sport. So Mike, that's Hello. Your introduction.
Thanks for having us on.
You're going to tell us everything about rugby league, why it's a brilliant, why it's a great sport, why it's better than rugby union, and why Celtic fans should bother about it.
Yeah, I mean, I thought of turning your question back on you before that intro and saying, what was your first rugby league game and who was your first rugby league hero?
my first rugby league game would have been Workington against somebody, but I couldn't tell you who. Since Workington have really made it into the top flight, it probably wouldn't have been a household name. And my first I'm gonna say my rugby league hero was not a player, but it was Eddie Waring, because my memory really is going down to Whitehaven, where we used to joke it was like going back in time 20 years in the 70s when we went down there, going down to Whitehaven and my mum's dad just sitting watching rugby league, Eddie Waring, commentary of, oh, the poor lad, and the like. So that's my earliest memories of rugby league.
So that sets you, that's going back a long time. My dad was at that game in That's the 1968 Challenge Cup final.
Yeah, I mean, there. I didn't see that, but it's so famous, it's so ingrained, that Challenge League, Challenge Cup final commentary.
He's something of a controversial figure within rugby league, because he's, a lot of people would say, you know, he was an evangelist for the game and would bring people in through his sort of slightly, shall we say, idiosyncratic way of talking. But then there's a lot of people who would say that he's kind of an embarrassment for the game. He made rugby league kind of, you know, because he was on it to knockout as well, and he sort of collated the two.
I suppose it would reinforce the stereotypical patronising flat cat whippet concept, because his voice was so regionally pronounced.
To me, this is the best way to describe it is really like a dichotomy, because rugby league, as we understand it, that I grew up with, for example, I'm from Rochdale, so we're, you know, my first game was, I think, Rochdale against Carlisle in 1994, which is about as bleak as it gets. I remember Workington playing in the Super League, believe it or not, in 1996, their last appearance in the top flight. And so for me growing up, it was something that was completely ingrained in our culture of, you know, Rochdale's on the border of being Manchester and border of being Lancashire. So you got United and you got City. I mean, more City where I grew up, although, you know, it's difficult to say. But then obviously in my life, rugby league was the biggest thing, beyond reproach, the biggest thing. And it was very much like, it's about class. It's about identity of coming from the north of England, particularly. But then to flip it, my partner is from Sydney, where it's as big as soccer is in Glasgow, rugby league is in Sydney. So it's a glamorous sport. You know, the players are the celebrities. You know, my father used to coach the Ireland national team in the mid-1990s when that was, I mean, literally their first ever game. He was the joint coach. And the other guy who he coached was a guy called Terry Flanagan, who you might remember because he played for Great Britain in the 80s. He was a big player for Oldham. Mm-hmm. His son, Mark Flanagan, still plays in the Super League now for Salford. He played in the Grand Final last year. And he has a coffee shop in the middle of Manchester. And you can walk down the street in Manchester and basically be unrecognised, other than people saying, you know, fucking hell, you're massive, because he is. But when he played one season on the edges of the West Tigers team in Sydney, he couldn't walk down the street. And it was an amazing thing, because he's from Oldham. He's, I think, the only privately educated player in the league, which I guess we'll come on to that aspect of it. But the way that he could be in Manchester, in ostensibly the heartland of rugby league, and be utterly unrecognised, but then in Sydney he's the biggest star. But then if he was to go from Manchester and get on the bus and go to Oldham or Wigan or somewhere like that, he would again be the biggest star. And it's a very unusual situation, because it's, rugby league has developed as a game essentially for towns, based around the way that the architecture of the north of England in the 1890s. And it's basically stayed like that, where if you happen to live in Liverpool or Manchester, rugby league is non-existent in your life. But if you live 10 miles away in Rochdale or in St Helens or Warrington, it's the number one sport. And it's quite difficult to work out why, without talking about where the game came from, what made the game happen. And I think it's sort of interesting for an audience of Celtic fans as well to think of how the game didn't develop, say, in Scotland in the way that it did develop in England. And rugby never took off in Scotland to the same extent, particularly among working class people, the way that it did in England. And I don't know how much I could go on without starting a potted history lesson of sport in the 1870s and 1880s and 1890s, which I guess people will understand from the history of Celtic to a lesser extent, or the history of Scottish football. But I mean, rugby league was, you have to imagine it. I actually tried to explain this to Americans yesterday in an article that I wrote for Forbes about why Americans should like rugby league. And the phrase I used was that there used to be one game of rugby called rugby that was existing from the 1850s, 60s, 70s all the way through. And then in the late 1880s, around the time Celtic was being formed, really, the TLDR version is that you couldn't, the posh people who ran rugby union, or rugby in general, as it was, there was only one at the time, couldn't square into their worldview that the working class people who, you know, worked down mines and in docks and harbours and, you know, cotton towns, could beat them or something. It didn't fit. And they said, well, the reason that they're beating us, they must be getting paid. And rugby union up until 1995 was the bastion of amateurism. It refused to have any countenance, any idea that you paid players. And it was something which very much came out of the private school system and out of the idea that you had, you know, muscular Christianity, all this nonsense. And what eventually happened was that the rugby league, the clubs that would form the rugby league, called their bluff and said, you know what, our guys who are, if they're going to play, then they need to be paid. They need to, what they call at the time, broken time payments, where you, if you worked down a mine and you had to take time off to play for Wigan, then you should be paid to compensate the time that you didn't spend working elsewhere, and people wouldn't have been able to survive otherwise. And the rugby, you know, this is what they fell out about. And so from the year dot of rugby league, 1895, the game's been defined by class. It was a game for working class people, organised for working class people, and it basically has maintained that identity to this day. Whether you talk about it as being an industrial northern game, or as the Tories, sort of the working class, the Workington man is a working class man. Mm-hmm. Like that's what the game is to this day been about. I mean, I actually, in this lockdown, I found a book in my house that's from the pre-Super League era. I think it was 1994 it was published, where it talks about different stories of people's experience of rugby league. And there was one in Workington and some in, you know, in Orland, in Wigan, in all over the place, even in Australia. And it's basically saying that, and that was, you know, that was 25 years ago from now. And you could have written that in 1994 or 1964 or 1914, and it would have roughly said the same thing. And it's interesting to think of it as the geography of the sport, because at the time, if you lived in Rochdale, for example, you worked in a mill in Rochdale, you went to watch Rochdale Hornets, and your big rival was Oldham or Swinton or Salford. And all of these little towns are now just Manchester. Like, they're indistinguishable from each other. But it's still this sort of mentality which is both slightly parochial and also a kind of united. And this is sort of a dichotomy that pervades within the game, because you have, on one hand, people from Wakefield will not countenance talking to people from Castleford. But on the other hand, they have a solidarity with people from Fiji and Tonga and New Zealand through the shared love of rugby league. And it's such a strange thing. I remember my dad, who's an evangelist for rugby league, you know, he's literally, his job was as rugby league development officer, going around and trying to convince people to play it in schools, a glorified PE teacher. And he always said that the problem with international rugby league was that you could convince somebody from Wakefield to hate somebody from Castleford, but you couldn't convince them to hate somebody from France. So how did you ever build a rivalry when all they wanted to do was beat somebody who lived 5 miles away? I'm kind of rambling a little bit here, but the concept which I hope is coming over is that this is such a, it has a terroir, like a meeting point of class and locality and circumstance that is indistinguishable from the places where it happens. You know, the mine and the stadium kind of coalesce with each other. And even in this post, you know, this society that we live in now, which is obviously not many people work down coal mines anymore or on docks or in cotton mills, but this mentality still exists, where there's perhaps a solidarity between people who like the same sport, which is, I guess, partly to do with their own experiences of the game as being something that's uniquely ours, but also something that, you know, is always existing in opposition. You know, we formed our game in opposition to the way that we saw the game of rugby as was being run, and said, you know, we don't have to deal with this anymore. And so started his own thing. And the way that the game has moved on since then has kind of only crystallized that idea more. I hope that made sense.
Yeah, so to get back, because obviously it's a podcast about rugby league and it's going to be talking to some Celtic supporters. They will be aware of the sport. But a lot of people, I mean, don't know the difference between rugby league and rugby union. And so you've touched on it there. For me, the intrinsic part of it is rugby league was always the perfect, when I was growing up, rugby league was the professional sport. Rugby union was the sport of posh people. Rugby league was the sport of working class people in the industrial heartlands of the north of England. And And then the other aspects of that are there's some nuances, one of the nuances, one of a better way of putting it, is there's a different number of players on the pitch, and you have a better turnaround of play because of restrictions in the tackle and things like that. So, but for me, as someone who's always liked something that's the contrary of it, I always liked rugby league. Obviously, my relatives were into it, but it was because it was much more ingrained into being part of the community and part of society. I've never really been a fan of rugby union, where people seem to be, if the opposition scored a good try, then that's brilliant because it was a great try on the pitch. And they never seem to be passionate about their own team in the way that football is, whereas rugby league seemed to be much more of a sport where people were passionate about their team in it. So if you want to give people a sort of a basic overview, is they'll be aware there's two codes of rugby. Just from a basic perspective, what's the difference between the two?
So, I mean, to touch briefly on what you said there, I think you've pulled up at what I think is a really important point in the way that rugby league is supported. It is supported like football, but without the animosity. Like, people go and they intrinsically want their team to win. You do occasionally get that, oh, that was a good try, but you don't really get it the same extent you do in rugby union. You know, not everybody goes quiet when somebody kicks a goal. They're still behind the goals flicking the visa and you're trying to put them off. But you don't get the hassle and the violence and stuff like that to anywhere near the same extent. Anyway, so the practical difference, and I think this kind of follows on for what I was talking about with the history, is that once you've got a professional game, even in 1895, you then people have to go and pay to see it, to fund the players. So then every rule change that has taken place since 1895 has been aimed towards making the game more spectator-friendly, in terms of whether it was promoting running rugby rather than, you know, collapsing scrums on top of each other. I mean, if I watch rugby union, I'm just like, these people are terrible at rugby, you know. And it's because rugby union was fundamentally organised around the people who played it. And so the idea that if you play in the World Cup final for England against the All Blacks, whoever, you should have the same experience as somebody playing for Old Etonians 15ths against somebody, you know. Whereas in rugby league, it was always organised around how do we make the game the most enjoyable product for the person in the stand rather than the person playing casually on a Saturday afternoon. So what you see is, over the years, the game has got faster and faster. It's got more emphasis on running and passing and tackling hard, as opposed to, you know, pushing each other on the ground and the ball just disappears for 5 minutes. So there is an element of televisuality to it now as well, like where people are aware that most of the game is seen on television, so they want the game to be as televisual a product as possible. And if you watch the NRL this weekend, this is their forte. They are the absolute masters of it. It looks more like, you know, if you watch the English Super League, it can look a little bit low rent. Frankly, it's quite hard to be glamorous about Wakefield against Huddersfield in the same way it is against, you know, Sydney against Melbourne looks in the sunshine, looks a little bit better on television. So I think the key things that you need to know to watch a rugby league game is that there's 13 players as opposed to 15, which was obviously done to make more space on the field so that you could run around a bit more. You only have 6 tackles to play, whereas in rugby union you can pretty much go infinitely, which again I think promotes not doing anything with the ball, whereas in rugby league you will lose the ball eventually. And you have a lot more. When you get tackled, you get up and you play the ball that's called backwards and you go again. So the idea that you should be tackled, get up and get going again as quickly as possible so that the defence, which has to retreat, doesn't have time to retreat. That's kind of the essence of the tactics of it, is whoever wins the tackle on the ground has got the best chance of winning the game because it makes the other team more tired. And when you look at truly elite level rugby league, it's very much a game of trying to make the other team more tired and trying to make, you know, physically impact the team and dominate the physical contest. The line that's always trotted out is that rugby union is a contact sport and rugby league is a collision sport. And I can't really put it better than that, where the idea in rugby league is to whack the other guy, or, you know, even in attack, when you run in, you try and knock the other guy out of the way so that you can get down and get the ball running as quickly as possible again. you don't really have a territoriality aspect to it in the same way that you do in rugby union. And I think one of the things that as a rugby league evangelist, kind of, it's hard for me to say because I grew up playing the game since I was 4 years old, but I would hope that rugby league is far easier to watch as a casual fan and be able to understand what's happening, rather than, I've also watched rugby union since I was a child, and if I watch a game now, I'm just like, what is going on? Why was that a penalty? Sorry, can we go back and explain what that particular minuta was? That doesn't really happen in rugby league. The game is geared around the ball being in play as much of the time as possible so that, you get as many tries, as many tackles, as many of all the stuff that you kind of want out of a game of rugby as possible.
So we've got the NRL starting this week, which is interesting from two perspectives. One, to give people an idea that rugby league is, particularly in around the Sydney area, is the biggest sport in Australia. Yeah, in a country that loves its sport and is successful at cricket and rugby union and increasingly football and swimming, to then put through all of those, there is a premier sport above those that maybe doesn't have the worldwide attention that the others do. So it's the big sport. It's getting going. And the other really interesting thing for me is they are planning, if it goes well, to have spectators in the stadium on the 1st of July.
Yeah, I mean, the potted history in Australia a little bit, or the most relevant thing is that there's a thing called what they call the Barassi line, which is after an Aussie rules player called, I think, Ron Barassi. And it's basically, if you draw a line from Victoria and New South Wales, anything south of that is Aussie rules and anything north of that is rugby league. So rugby league is Queensland and New South Wales, which is the big rivalry. And if you want to see some high quality punch-ups, just put in Origin fight Queensland, New South Wales, and you'll get some high quality Australian blokes thumping each other, which, guilty pleasures. So in Australia, it is unquestionably the biggest winter sport. Now, everybody kind of plays cricket in the summer, but in the winter, rugby league is king in Sydney and in Queensland. So if you're in New South Wales, Queensland, Brisbane, that sort of place, then rugby league is by a distance, the biggest sport. So I think you have nine clubs in the Sydney area. So every district kind of has its own little thing, plus the teams in Melbourne and New Zealand and Canberra and other places. So I think the idea of getting fans into... They were very optimistic. Let's wind it back a bit. Like, the idea that they were going to start playing on May the 28th, when they first announced that, it was like, this is impossible. That cannot... There's no way that can happen. And they've made it happen in a sort of, I don't know what your experiences of Australians are, but as someone who lives with one, this sort of pig-headed, like, we're going to do it and it's just a singularity that this is now going to happen, is a very Australian trait from my experience. And they've done it. And I wrote articles for Forbes at the time saying that this was just, like, good luck with that, lads. But they've managed to pull it off. And I think it's partly to do with Australia's handling of the coronavirus in general, but also, like, very much where there's a will, there's a way. Like, this is, if you're the government of New South Wales, the government of Queensland, and the federal government of Australia in general, like, you want this on because this distracts so many people. It's the same as getting Premier League football up and running in England in terms of importance to just the average guy on the street. Getting footy, as they would call it, back on telly is a massive thing. I mean, Scott Morrison, who's their prime minister, is literally Cronulla Sharks' number one season ticket holder. He regularly turns up at their games. Like, so he's, everybody from the Prime Minister down is into the idea of getting rugby league back on television, pronto. As for the stuff in the stands, I think that's very much the idea and they would like it to happen. But I would have said the 28th of March was fanciful and I now think July the 1st is fanciful, but we'll see. The problem they actually have, which kind of nobody wants to talk about, is that because as in England, Australian Rugby League is also quite local and national at the same time. It has this duality. Mm-hmm. So if you're one of the major clubs, if you're, say, the Penrith Panthers are funded by a massive selection of what's called leagues clubs, which is basically little mini casinos and working man's clubs all over Western Sydney. And until they can open the pubs, they can't open. So they need to get their they need to get people in the stands, and they need to get people watching on telly, because that kind of furthers the argument that they should get people back in the on the pokies, as they would call it, on the gambling machines, which is what keeps the tills going over. So it's an interesting sort of, you know, imagine if Air United were dependent on people going and playing on the quizzer in the pub. That's kind of a little bit like it, except there's thousands of them, you know.
Yeah, so they are really keen to get up and running and get spectators in. For me, I mean, obviously, nobody wants a second wave or any of these things, but I am also, I'm an eternal optimist, and I'm looking for light at the end of the tunnel as to when the worst of this will be over. And so having a country that's going to have, maybe they're a bit early, it doesn't happen the 1st of July, but say it happens by the 1st of August, having a country with mass spectator sports and seeing what that does to the infection rate and the numbers is really interesting to see if they can move forward and actually keep the virus under control.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is as well, like the importance of rugby league to just general Australian society is massive, particularly if you're in Sydney or New South Wales. And I know that the Aussie rules, the AFL, they're trying to do it in Melbourne as well for exactly the same reasons. In terms of making people feel like it's normal, like the NRL's happening, everything's going to be fine. Like this is, you know, Australians are probably the most sport-obsessed country on earth, and this is like their number one thing. So they kind of, the idea that you could get that up and going makes everybody feel a lot better about the situation. They've had a couple of issues because there's quite a lot of anti-vaxxers in Australia.
It really doesn't surprise me that Australia might be that type of country.
Yeah, do you know what, when it happened, right, I got onto one of my mates, who's not a rugby league fan at all, but he is from Sydney, and I was like, is this just the sort of person who either plays rugby league, or more accurately is the sort of Instagram influencer who is married to a rugby league player, is likely to get into this magic beans nonsense? And I was like, is that an intrinsically Australian thing, or is it, you know, would a load of soccer players' wives be into it as well? And he said to me it was slightly an Australian thing, where it's very sort of in tune with nature. There is that thread running through it. But yeah, this was an issue where they said, okay, everybody's got to get flu shots, not coronavirus vaccines, but just normal flu vaccines, because they're obviously going into their winter now. So in an attempt to minimize any sort of outbreak of any description, they were like, okay, everybody's got to get a flu vaccine. A couple of them went, well, I'm not doing that. And they, you know, I think a couple of the Pacific Islander players claimed a religious exemption, because a lot of them are very religious in a variety of different ways. And then some of them were just like, no, I don't believe in vaccines. And this was a huge thing. The other thing that's probably worth mentioning about the NRL is that if you can imagine what the bad behavior of rugby union players is, you know, drinking pints of each other's piss and stuff like that, that culture doesn't really exist in rugby league, certainly in my experience. But if you give a load of meat-headed working class guys a stack of wages, they tend to act like arseholes.
Yeah.
That is also the stereotype. There's a phrase, if you meet sort of young Australian people, who would say that I was NRL drunk, which basically means that's about as hammered as you can get. Being mad with it is occasionally referred to as being NRL drunk. So there is a theory as well that among the league, that the longer that they leave their own players to their own devices is potentially hazardous, because these are guys who are stupid enough. I mean, watch NRL and you'll see just how brutal and tough a game it is. And these guys are the ones who are, you know, optimized to play it. So they're left on their own devices. They're not people who would, I think, enjoy a lot of time spent with their own thoughts, put it that way. It wouldn't take them very long.
So we're going to do another podcast where we talk about comparisons of the economics of rugby league to Scottish football, because I always use that in all the examples. UK, back to the UK. I always use that in examples when I'm comparing across. But one of the things that you mentioned, the Super League being nothing compared to the NRL in terms of sports production quality, but I still do think it's Scottish football could learn from Super League. So if people were to tune in and watch the NRL this week, who are they going to be seeing? And, you know, what's so special about the sports production that they do for it?
I mean, firstly, like the way that the NRL is presented is relentlessly positive. Like, you don't hear, certainly on the broadcast, like there's obviously a huge media industry around it, newspapers and everything, podcasts, whatever, in which people are a lot more critical. But when you see the broadcast, you know, they talk about like bad decisions by the referees and stuff like that, but everything is spectacular. Everything is, you know, impressive. And they have a very colloquial, for want of a better word, colloquial way of talking, which maybe is just the way that Australians present. You know, I don't watch enough Australian television other than rugby league to see if this is true. But the way that the commentators talk about it is with a level of enthusiasm for the product that you very rarely see on, you know, Ian Crocker does not do this on SPFL coverage. So there's that, which kind of gets you in. It's very bright colours, bright kits. Everybody's kind of very happy to be there. And I mean, it is just, maybe this is me, the rugby league purist, talking, but it is just a great product as well. It's everything you want from rugby league. It's fast and it's hard hits and it's spectacular tries and you know, high skill level, which potentially, I mean, you don't see that every week as much in the Super League just because the players aren't as good as they are in the NRL, because the best Super League players, especially in recent years, have ended up playing in the NRL. We could have a whole other very technical argument about whether the style of play in Super League is better than the NRL, because some people would say that, but you know, that's for another day. But the way, particularly with like the branding, the way that, you know, instead of, I mean, the example I would use is that there was a time a couple of years ago where if you watched Wakefield against Castleford, one team was sponsored by Unison and the other one was sponsored by GMB. So that was your, you know, you advertise for the audience that you have. And if you watch the NRL, it's sponsored by, you know, KFC and like big international brands, because that's where you're the mass audience is watching rugby league. And all little things like that just give you the impression that this is a much bigger deal, you know? So obviously this round that's going to be happening this weekend is behind closed doors. But because they basically had to redraw the competition, they stopped after two rounds in March. They'd only just started. And so they've had to rejig the competition a little bit to be like, okay, we're only going to play X amount of games now because of the weeks that we've lost, etc. And so they've started off basically with the top four teams playing each other. So on Thursday's the first game, which is Brisbane against Parramatta, who are two of the sort of most famous, recognisable brands of the competition. Like Brisbane Broncos would get 40,000 fans for every home game. They're the most supported team. And then Parramatta they just got a new stadium last year, and I guess they would be the second most supported team in terms of a regular weekend with fans in the stadium. These are the Western Sydney and Brisbane is like the absolute heartlands of the game in Australia. So they would be, you know, two of the biggest, the best supported teams. On Friday, which I guess I think it kicks off at 9 or 10 a.m. UK time. I think it's 11:30 my time here. I live in the Netherlands. So it would be 10:30 a.m. on Friday morning. I think it's even on Sky. You probably already pay for it. That'll be Sydney Roosters, who are the reigning champions, against South Sydney Rabbitohs, who previously were a lot of British people's favourite team because they had four British players, mm-hmm. Four who, in typical Dewsbury fashion, were four brothers. The Sam Burgess, who would be the most famous British rugby league player of probably the last 10-15 years. He just retired. He was too beat up to play anymore. Because rugby league will do that to you after a while, but his brother will still be playing. That's the team that's owned by Russell Crowe as well, who's probably the most famous rugby league fan in the world. He's a co-owner of the team. So the Sydney Roosters against South Sydney Rabbitohs, that's going to be that's a real big deal. It's a local derby. I mean, it's the reigning champions against maybe the fourth best team. And then on the Saturday, you get Melbourne Storm against Canberra Raiders, which is the second against the third best team. So they've really drawn it to be like, you know, come back with a bang. I think a lot of British people now have moved from South Sydney Rabbitohs to a lot of Super League fans have now gone towards Canberra Raiders because they've got, four British players now. They've just signed a new halfback from Wigan. So a lot of players who play for the England national team also play for the Canberra Raiders now. And they're a very sort of exciting team to watch. They're kind of being the sort of young and up and coming, whereas Melbourne Storm, they're like, I wrote this piece before for American people, I compared them to the Patriots, where they were the great dynasty, but have now been, they've lost a lot of their best players have retired. So it's, I mean, the likes of, there's a guy called Billy Slater, for example, who's one of the greatest players of all time. He just retired 2 years ago. And so they're kind of rebuilding, but they still know their way around and kind of win on instincts a lot of the time. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, especially without this, you know, people, it takes them so long to do preseason, to get up to full match fitness and then stop after 2 weeks. And then nobody really knows what the effect of what would be on that, almost 2.5 months without playing any games. So that's going to be on the league. So it's, I mean, you're going to have the best players out there. You're going to have an incredible production of, you know, 15 million cameras and everybody raring to go. But then the question is, can they actually do it? Because no one, as we saw with the Bundesliga a little bit, everyone's kind of rusty. You don't really know what the effect's going to be, and particularly in rugby league where it's such a technical high-speed game, whether it can be picked up without any preseason games, that any of that will be, it'll be interesting to see. But I don't think anybody who watches it would be disappointed by the action. If you want to, you know, if you think that you've been missing the idea of like high value sport, then yeah, the NRL is certainly that, regardless of anyone being there or not. I don't think particularly, like, if you watch the Bundesliga, obviously the crowd, particularly in Germany, is such a big part of the experience of watching the Bundesliga. Whereas in the NRL, it's not really the same culture. It's a lot of people go to the games, but you don't have like the organized fan support. You don't have like people singing and stuff like that. It's very much what's happening on the field, which will be the same. So I would think it would transfer better. I mean, the last round that they played behind closed doors was a little bit strange because you could hear the players shouting to each other, but in general was no worse than any other round that you would watch. So I'm confident that won't be a massive issue.
Interesting that they decided to go with the big games up front. You know, you might have thought, if they are planning to have spectators in the ground inside, you know, in a month's time, you might have thought that they would maybe try and save up the spectator games for the ones with the big crowds. But I suppose the counter to that would be, once they open the doors, people are going to turn up regardless.
Yeah, this has been. Certainly in the plans that were released last week to get the Super League playing again, this has been something that they've talked about, to say, like, why don't we do the first games if we have to play behind closed doors? I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about this in the comparison podcast, but rugby league is also heavily dependent on match day revenue in the same way that Scottish football is. So would you rather play Wakefield against Huddersfield, which regularly would get, you know, quite a small crowd, behind closed doors, and then arrange it so that Wigan against St Helens, which would sell out the whole stadium, is played when you can allow people in? Obviously, that makes a little bit more sense. So if Super League has to go through the same process, it's possible that they will rejig their fixtures so that the high value fixtures happen at a time that's more amenable to people actually being able to go to the game. But in Australia, it's less of an issue. The main issue that they had was that the way that they had weighted their TV contract was, they worked out they were losing, I think, 13 million Aussie dollars, so about 7 or 8 million pounds, every single round. So it was a case of get the games back on and get them, you know, get as many people watching it as possible. And they just thought, you know what, this needs to happen now. And I think the way that they've marketed is really clever, because one of the traditions in Australian rugby league is to have like a huge launch at the start of the year. They do a lot of, you know, they'll get someone to do a song or whatever. Like Tina Turner famously did it in the 90s. And I warn you in advance that one of them was simply the best. But there's a much better one. If you put in Tina Turner, Winfield Cup, there's a brilliant video. I think the song is called What You Get Is What You See. And it is an example of why Australians were not factoring in how homoerotic some of their content was at the time. It's a lot of very muscly men in very tight speedos to a Tina Turner song. And nobody in Australia ever just went, oh, funny, brilliant, and without any innuendo at all. But they go through this process every year, and it's a big thing. Like Bon Jovi did it 1 year as well, where it's, you know, who's going to do the song, who's going to do the league promo launch. And so the idea that they've got to do that a second time now for the relaunch has kind of been a big deal. I actually tweeted out today this video that's produced by Fox, who broadcasts it in Australia, and it's just unbelievable little montage put together. You think you think of the nonsense that gets put out by Sky, both in Scottish football and rugby league, and you think, why don't they do something like that? You know? Although I've always caveated with, it's a lot easier to sell Sydney against Brisbane than it is to sell Wakefield against Castleford.
Yeah, so we've got that coming up, and then for those, because there will be some Celtic fans who listen to this, there'll be people that we've got listeners in Australia, and of course we've got some in the north of England. When is the Super League coming back?
Well, yeah, that's the big question. They've released a few, or I don't know if it was officially released or it was leaked, a couple of plans of when Super League might return. The problem, a lot of the problem with Super League is that the Super League has two teams who aren't based in the UK.
Yep.
So you have the Catalans Dragons, who are based in the south of France, and then you've got the Toronto Wolfpack, which is just an amazing story, who are based, obviously, in Toronto. Actually, they're based in Rochdale, weirdly, in a college in Rochdale. I used to do soccer schools there. It's really weird. You see their social media content, and you're like, oh yeah, that's where I used to go to soccer school when I was 11, you know, and the summer holidays. But yeah, so the idea of how do you get people from Toronto and people from France, where they've obviously different systems. It's a little bit like trying to get the Champions League or the UEFA or the any UEFA competitions up and running again, which the NRL does have to deal with as well, because they've got the New Zealand Warriors, but obviously New Zealand's coronavirus situation is roughly similar to Australia's. So they've been able to sort of work that out, and you know, you're dealing with two partners who already know each other, whereas it's a bit more different when you're dealing with, you know, France and Canada and England, yep, and all that sort of stuff. So I think the soft signal is that it's going to be the start of August, which would allow, so the big things in rugby league, you have obviously the league, and then you play the playoffs to the grand final, which is a huge event, sells out Old Trafford pretty much every year in the international break in October. It's always that international break. And then you've got the Challenge Cup final, which would have actually have been this year, it would have been in July, and they're trying to move it further forward in the year. It used to be in May since you know, the Donkey's years, and then they moved it to August bank holiday. Mm-hmm. And then they've been trying to move it back in the year. And now this year, it's been postponed, and they're looking to get the Challenge Cup in, because there's this, kind of coming back to what we spoke about before, there's this collective identity around rugby league that kind of transcends clubs, to the point where if you go to the Challenge Cup final at Wembley, it's like 10, you know, it'll be like 10,000 Leeds fans, 10,000 Warrington fans, and then the rest of it will just be people who go because they like to go to the Challenge Cup final. So you see every single shirt, every amateur club, every league club, in a way that's, you know, it'd be, imagine if you had that at the Scottish Cup final, where just every amateur club in Scotland, every boys club sent a bus, you know. It's a little bit like that. So you go and you see people you haven't seen for years, you see clubs, you know, we always play rugby league train spotting, where you try and get one shirt from every single.
Yeah.
I always try and find one in a Manly Seagull stop so I can take a picture and say I've met my girlfriend's dad.
Do you know, the thing about that, though, is to again, it gets back to the why, and we'll go into this in more detail on the podcast about the economics of it, but the Super League was able to be created because at the end of the day, there is a collectivism about rugby league. Because for a simplistic way of putting it, from my perspective, their common enemy is union.
Yeah, everybody hates rugby union. Like, it's the sort of thing where you see a lot of people will say, you know, a lot of union fans will say, oh, like, I watch union, but I like a bit of league. Very rarely do you hear it the other way around.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of people who, I mean, it's got better in recent years since they've become more and more professional. But I can remember in sort of the early 2000s watching England Rugby Union, when England won the World Cup, for example, at Rugby Union, thinking, like, you wouldn't be professionals at Rugby League. Like, such was the gap in core skills.
Yeah.
I just think they wouldn't be sufficiently good at the standard passing, tackling, etc. And look, I play Rugby League here in the Netherlands, which there is a Rugby League competition in the Netherlands. And there's a couple of the lads that we play with who've come across from Rugby Union. And so I get them to walk me through. If I was watching, you know, the Six Nations was on telly or something like that, or we went to the pub to watch the World Cup or whatever, and I would just be like, how are these people, like, you're going to have to explain this to me, because they aren't very good at it. Like, every try you see would be because people couldn't tackle properly. And I think, like, I could go and watch Rochdale Mayfield against Wigan St Patrick's, and they'd be better at fucking tackling than this, you know, in an amateur game. And there is, but there is this kind of, a lot of rugby union fans would say it was sort of a northern chippiness about our level of opposition to it. But it's, I mean, maybe there's rugby league fans out there in the world who have less oppositional relationship to rugby union than I do, but I don't know many of them, put it that way. But there is this idea that at some point, even when the game broke away in 1895, it was because people had to come together. You know, there's no point having a split from something if then half of the split is split and form their other version. Yeah. You all kind of have to go collectively. And they managed to do that and set up a competition and set up a thing that still pervades to this day. It's going to be 125 years old. So that level of, like, we need to do something for the game, it's the kind of, you know, if you read the rugby league press, like, rugby league's been a dying game for the previous 125 years, like, and it still manages to continue, largely due to the fact that it's such a collectively minded thing. People realise that the rugby league is more important than one of individual club, or, you know, there's no point Wigan winning every league. You know, the example I always think of is that I like Celtic more than I like football, but I like rugby league more than I like Hull FC, the team that I support. Like, if Hull FC stopped existing, I would still watch rugby league. I would, you know, probably wouldn't want any particular team to win as much as I want Hull FC to win. Whereas if Celtic stopped existing, well, I mean, go speak to people in the other end of Glasgow for that one. But
now, it's interesting that you're a Hull FC fan. So explain the rivalry in Hull.
Well, how long have you got? So I'm from Rochdale, but my dad is from Hull, which is why I support Hull FC. I'm interested because Hull boys on this podcast, I've never worked out which one he supports and whether I should like him or not. We don't associate with their type. The short answer is it's East Hull and West Hull. So Hull is unique, really, among rugby league cities in that it has a local derby in the way that we would understand it in football, of like one. So Wigan against St Helens, whilst being next to each other, are two different towns. Or, you know, Leeds against Bradford is two different cities, whereas Hull is Hull KR and Hull FC. And they just, yeah, it's an interesting rivalry because it's neither team historically have been particularly good. I would compare it, Hull FC is kind of like Newcastle, maybe, where the size of the club somewhat outweighs how good it is. I mean, when I was a kid, my dad always tried to make us Bradford Bulls fans because it was closer and he didn't have to drive as far to take us to watch Hull FC. Because he was like, I've watched Hull FC since 1958 and they've been shit. So he didn't want us to go through the same pain, but, you know, we're still going watching Hull FC. Rovers, they're subhuman scum. What can I say?
Well, you see, your problem is I am 90% certain that Hull boy is not a Hull FC fan.
Oh. Well, the thing is as well, though, like you regularly see, you know, if you go to watch Hull against Rovers, there's both fans in both ends. There will be like an away end with whatever team's away in it. But a lot of the time, you know, if Hull get to the, well, Hull, thankfully, have got to the cup final and won it in recent memory, and there'll be all fans there sat with Rovers fans next to them because he's my brother or he's my cousin or he lives next door to me or something like that. And that, so you do have that, and it's not like when you see one token Everton fan in the Liverpool end and they all should get on TV and go, oh, it's the friendly derby. That happens in every single derby. So there is, you know, you don't have that I don't know what the word would be, sort of the aggression's there, but the aggression is not in the same way. You very rarely do you see like any sort of hassle or anything like that. And it's always been the great argument, which I've never understood, particularly with the alcohol ban in Scottish football and the way that I used to be able to watch Hull FC on a Friday night. And then if I went to watch Hull City on the Saturday afternoon, I would be able to drink in my Hull FC top and go back the next day in the same stadium, sit in the same seat and not be able to drink. For this sort of arbitrary, because the ball being played with in front of me was a different shape. And, you know, you go to the grand final at Old Trafford, you can drink. You go to the Challenge Cup final, you can drink. But then you can't do it for a football game. And it's a lot of it is to do with the way that football has essentially has been historically very bad at collectively organising for itself. Whereas rugby league, there's a lot of faults with the people who run rugby league, but I've always seen them as being pretty good at, you know, trying to trying to get a deal for the sport that works well. And I think a lot of people who, you know, who watch rugby league and follow it like I do would always say that the RFL, which is our version of the SFA, are kind of a load of suits in Leeds who sit and do nothing. But they do, historically, if you look at the way that the game has progressed over time, I think it generally has been for the better, in terms of, like, a lot of the funding that the game got comes from Sport England, which they had to go out and lobby to get. Or the way that they, even recently, they've just got an 18 million quid cash injection from the government to help them tide over through coronavirus because of the argument that they made. And you might say that there's an element of circumstance that the Tories have just taken a load of seats in rugby league areas that might give them a reason to think that they need to keep these voters. But the way that rugby league lobbied collectively to say, look, Workington Town is the art of Workington, you might not think it makes any money in, you know, they might be semi-professional at that level. But if you live in Workington, this is the most important thing that your town has. There's nothing else going on in Swinton. There's nothing else going on in Featherston or somewhere like that other than the rugby league team. Mm-hmm. And they've been able to present that case to say, look, this is a vital part of community life in this part of the world. And if you, and I feel like if, you know, you would never get the unity in Scottish football that Ayr and Raith Rovers and Inverness could all come together and say, do you know what, we're vital to the life of Kirkcaldy or whatever, in a way that rugby league's been able to do consistently. Certainly, since Super League came in, where they've been able to act more decisively and collectively.
Well, that's one of the key things, because there's the discussion going on about restructuring of Scottish football on a temporary measure, basically because Hearts want it because they don't want to be relegated, and Partick Thistle want it because they don't want to be relegated. Now, for me, as a not someone watching it every second of the day, but the interesting thing about rugby league is they were able to look at it and say, how do we, you know, nearly 30 years ago now, they looked at it and said, how are we going to survive commercially? We have to create a product that's going to maximise the revenue that Sky's going to give us. Basically what they did. And then they looked at, and so they then moved the calendar of the game to give Sky their demographic of viewer, that they gave them their football demographic in the summer. And then they also were pretty, you know, you've touched on having the Catalan Dragons in Toronto, and we'll get onto this in more detail, but they've been pretty pragmatically ruthless in saying, these are the teams that we need to have participating to maximise what we can get.
Yeah, this is the, I mean, as I said, I was reading a book that was from 1994 that was persuading the Super League. It was called 13 Winters, and it was talking about the title referenced the fact that the winters were ending and it was going to become a summer game. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the people who, I mean, I get into this argument constantly. I stop arguing with people on the internet about this. So I'm 31 years old, right? So I remember the very, very tail end of Winter Rugby League. My first game would have been in like October 1994 or something like that. And I can remember, you know, pre-Super League and the 95 World Cup, which was sort of the last bit of the old world, as it were. And I can remember going to like Odsell Stadium at a time when Bradford were the world champions of rugby league, and there were no toilets. Like, the toilets was a wall behind a slightly shorter wall. So that you walk behind wall one and pissed on it. And then at the end of the game, you could go on the pitch and just like kick a ball around. And my dad would go to the bar and I'd go and kick a ball around. And he thought, this isn't really the behaviour of the world champions of anything, you know? And it was still, you still had this thing where the game sort of saw itself as being, right, we need to be this Sky TV product. But it was still intrinsically, I think, based in local communities in the north of England. And the way that they've attempted to expand beyond that is sort of a great, I mean, I can only give my own opinion because it's still this day a greatly debated thing among, I mean, for me, you can look at the numbers and say, like, more people watch rugby league than they used to, way more used to. People sort of, they always have this problem where people say, oh, you know, how many average people in the British street could name rugby league players the same way they used to be able to name Martin Afire and Ellery Hanley. Or, you know, And you think, well, yeah, but how many people actually go to the stadium? How many people actually watch the game on television? Because it's way up on what it used to be. The game, you look at the product that was the BBC showing five games a year in 1990, and what you have now where you can watch 100 games a year in front of stadiums that have been renovated and that my mum would actually want to go to. Like, my mum is Irish and, you know, she used to go watch Cliftonville in the 70s, so she's hardly put off by terrible stadiums. But she was much more likely to go and watch a game that's played in a nice stadium than one that doesn't have women's toilets, which was the case if you went to Oddsall in 1996.
Yeah.
So, you know, and this is one of the things which I've always... I mean, we can talk about the class element of rugby league, but in terms of, like, diversity, in terms of inviting people in, like, rugby league has been light years ahead of almost every other sport in terms of... It has sort of the highest participation levels of women, particularly women fans, in a way that would put pretty much every other major men's professional sport to shame in the number of women who attend games. I mean, if you go to the Magic Weekend, you will see the finest women in I mean, really putting the women of the North of England, like, the way that people get into the game, it's not like an exclusively male pastime the way that Scottish football is a lot of the time. I mean, it's got better in recent years, but rugby league has always been a fairly I would say there's obviously more men than women, but has often been like 30% women as opposed to 10%. And in terms of, like, I mean, not to bash rugby union, though it is my favourite sport, but like Great Britain had had a black captain of rugby league at rugby league before it had a black player at rugby union. So like the advancement of like of people from immigrant backgrounds. I mean, I told you this sort of, you think of Glasgow as being this hub of Irish Catholic immigration, but like the two biggest Catholic towns in the UK are Warrington and St Helens. You know, and you have like clubs in the amateur system in rugby league where you have Wigan St Jude's, Wigan St Pat's, Wigan St Cuthbert's, Dewsbury Celtic, Oldham St Anne's, who are all based around the Catholic community, the Irish community. I mean, the Ireland rugby league team is entirely based up of players like me who grew up in England with Irish parentage. I know it's extremely proud to play for Ireland because there is always that link. You know, it's anywhere where you have working class people, you have diversity, and rugby league's been, as I say, light years ahead of almost every other sport in picking up and promoting that and saying if you're good enough to play rugby league, you're accepted at face value. That isn't to say there hasn't historically been racism and stuff like that as well as there has in every aspect of life, but I think like a lot of people who, especially coming from working class towns in England where you have, for example, strong trade union movement where if you were a black person, your ability to vote in a union is the same as a white person's. Like, the ability to play. And I know there's a guy called Seth Thompson who was a black player in Paul Workington, actually. Played in the 1958 Challenge Cup final for Workington. It's an inside joke for pretty much me and you, I think. but he was a black guy from Leeds who played in that. And he was his autobiography, so unfortunately died now. But his autobiography was amazing revelation, the life of just a random black guy who grew up in Leeds in the 1940s, and his life playing rugby league and the level of struggles that he had to go through, but also the way that he was accepted because he was good at rugby league. And that was the only thing that really, people really cared about. And you've often seen that in Australia as well, where the levels of participation for Australian Indigenous people, for people from Pacific Island heritages, is way, way higher than it is in any other sport. And it was, and also of Irish Catholic people. Rugby league in Australia was very much seen as an Irish Catholic game for a long time, especially in sort of, you know, 50, 60 years ago. So these things kind of, they do, the communities that the game comes from reflects the community of the game itself. And I think, I mean, I forgot the question now. I've kind of gone on a massive rant about this. These are the things that get into my head, you know. But the way that the game is today, like the way that it has been able to, I remember the question, the way that the game has been able to maneuver its competition to try and suit the way that it's presented to the world is kind of, it is one of the strengths where, you know, a lot of people fall out about this. So for example, we have changed our format way more often than Scottish football has. You know, you go through two divisions without relegation, even one point where they had the two divisions merged into three divisions that until recently. And it was, and they all basically have been done with the same goal in mind, which is to try and keep the clubs solvent, so we have a salary cap for those reasons, or to try and manufacture events that you can then put on Sky. Mm-hmm. So you have things like, they had this thing called the £1 million game, where they're basically a relegation playoff. So like the one that Rangers lost to Motherwell, famously, yeah. That game, was called the million pound game, and you basically had the bottom, the two teams playing off, one to stay in the league and one to come up. And they made this into this huge thing solely so that they could build up to it on Sky and make it an event that would draw in viewers. And because they're willing to work basically hand in hand with Sky throughout, knowing basically, I mean, it's we could go on all night about the reasons behind it, but they were lucky in the sense that in the 90s when Sky was, when they moved to show the game on Sky, Rupert Murdoch obviously is Australian, and he was in the process of trying to split the Australian game, onto his Fox network. So he had Super League in Australia as well, which then eventually merged back into what is now the NRL. But he knew that one of the best levers that he had to pull in Australia was to move the British competition to Super League and play under the Super League brand. So Rugby League was able to work collectively and say, do you know what, we're going to take this little, you know, foothold that we have, that you really want us to be on your TV station, and we're going to try and do something out of it. And at the time, they kind of had madcap ideas about merging, you know, long-established clubs like Wakefield and Castleford were going to be merged together and all this stuff that fans really, really hated the idea of. And eventually it didn't happen because of the respect, the ability of communities to organise against it, essentially, and say, do you know what, I'm not going to go, if I'm an LFC fan, I don't want to watch a team that's merged with OKR. Like, and eventually now they've got to a situation where the branding of these individual clubs with 100 years of history behind them and rooted in their communities kind of is the product. So on one hand, you've got the athleticism and stuff that happens on the field as product one, but also the authenticity of, you know, OFC being this brand that's existed since 1860-something and St. Helens being this brand with this history that you can then play back into. And so they've kind of managed to have the best of both worlds, where they've jigged the competition to something which is very new and pretty liable to change. Like, people are having the same discussion now, saying, well, we can't really relegate anybody from the league because we haven't played enough games. I think they only stopped after five or six games. And obviously they wouldn't want to countenance the idea of Catalans or Toronto getting relegated, which is also the great unspoken. But then how do we still promote teams from below, because they think that the teams who might come first and second in that is Toulouse and London, which obviously makes their... That kind of suits it. And there would be people who would say, well, as soon as that happens, the drawbridge will be mysteriously pulled up because they've got the guys that they want. Mm-hmm. Like, and they are conscious at every level. And I think in the heart of hearts, a lot of rugby league fans would appreciate it as well, that, like, even if I grew up watching Rochdale Hornets in Rochdale, like, Rochdale Hornets are probably not the same draw to the Super League that London Broncos are or that Toronto Wolfpack are. And that maybe what we're going through now is, like, is allowing the league to calcify into, okay, what does the game mean to the communities of the people who've grown up with it for forever, in terms of Swinton Lions and Rochdale Hornets and Oldham and places like that? And what does it mean to grow the game to have Toulouse and to have Toronto and stuff like that, which is ultimately where I think the growth of the game is going to be. Like, you don't need to convince people in Wigan to watch rugby league. You do need to convince people somewhere that isn't Wigan. And I think this is the sort of the great divide that currently exists, is whether you want to appeal to the people who've always liked the game and do what they like, or whether you want to try and make new people like the game. And the problem that Rugby League has is that it's such a specific demographic of people that what you're kind of forced to do is either try and make the game less authentic, like make it appeal to middle class people or people in Cornwall or whatever, or you try to go to a new market and replicate the demographic and say, well, actually, there's lots of people of exactly the same background but who live in the south of France, where rugby league has existed for 100 years and is a vibrant, strong game. Why don't we try and integrate them and bring in that television market and bring in this extra money? And then why don't we go to, say, Toronto, or there's a team going to start in Ottawa, and say, actually, people in Canada have shown an interest in this sort of sport through ice hockey, Canadian football, etc. Why don't we try and fill a gap in that market with our sport? And so this is the great question that no one's really come up with an answer to. And we kind of hope, for the good of the game, that all of this goes well and that Toronto is a viable, sustainable concern. But then, as with almost everything in sport, there is the question of, like, what happens if the Toronto owner does the Gretna owner, you know, and drops dead. Well, what happens then? Well, what happens if he just decides he's not interested anymore? And this is kind of, I mean, this is true. This isn't just a rugby league problem. This is everybody's problem. But rugby league has taken these steps to put itself out there and then kind of hope that it goes well.
So, which is what we'll talk on in the next podcast, because there's a lot of similarities there with Scottish football's dilemma. I mean, is it, you know, just to touch on briefly, as a Celtic fan, it's dead easy for me to sit here and say, do you know what, Scottish football should be top whack, top league of 10, top league of 12, next league of 16, or top league of 18 and next league of 10, but there should be no more than 30 teams or 20 odd teams in Scottish football who suck the money out, and those teams should be, and then basically list the teams and say, these are the teams that should be. Hamilton, nice as you add nothing to the league, bugger off. Dead easy for me to say that, because I support the team that's not affected by it. So we'll use these analogies to move on for the next one. I'm just conscious of the time. So if people are watching the NRL this week, who's the Eddie Bowman, the Gorley brothers, Bill Pattinson? Who are the star players that they should be watching out for?
So right, I'll give you your best example I can say is, right, if you watch the Roosters against Souths, which is at, I think, 10:30 a.m. on Friday morning. So on Friday morning, I think it's on Sky. So that's, you have James Tedesco, who'll be wearing the number one jersey for the Roosters. He's the current player of the year, and he's just grease lightning. He's rapid. You know, all of them are tough as anything. But he's particularly sort of elusive runner, very, very dangerous player to watch. You'll notice him immediately because he's probably going to be the best player on the field. On the other side, you have Latrell Mitchell. Now, I'm not sure if he's going to be able to play because he broke the lockdown rules, and there was a bit of a brouhaha in Australia about him. And he's the enfant terrible. He's the potential superstar, but has also, you know, he maybe doesn't behave as well as he could do. So he was at the Roosters last year and then walked out on them to join South. So this will be the first time he's playing against his old club. And he basically walked out because he knew that James Tedesco was too good at fullback at number one, and he wanted to play number one. So he's now moved to South so that he can play number one. And his first two games before the lockdown were less than successful because he's a real big boy and there's a lot of running involved in playing number one. That there isn't as much running involved in playing in the centres where he was before. And a lot of people would suggest that he's not quite, he may have enjoyed his off-season pies a little bit too much. But if he gets on the field, he's going to be the centre of attention because he's, you know, that's the big story, is Latrell returning to, and I'm shitting the bed here because I think he might be suspended. But if you watch it, Latrell Mitchell's good to watch. You also have number three for the Roosters, Joseph Marnie, who's a great player, just unbelievable hands. Like, you think he's tackled and then the ball just appears somewhere. He's a great player. Luke Carey, who hopefully, fingers crossed, will play for Ireland in the World Cup next year. If he doesn't get picked for Australia, he's going to come play for Ireland. He's sort of the schemer for the Roosters. He'll be the one who's, you know, you'll see him, a little guy shouting everybody around the field. He's got Campbell Graham, who plays for which sounds like he should play for Rangers in about 1950, but he's unbelievable hun name. He'll play for South Sydney. He's a great player. To be honest, across the field, what you'll see in the flow of the game is the tactics that, I mean, if you've not watched rugby league since it was on BBC in the, you know, in the 80s, the tactics of the game have changed a lot, because what you see is it's a lot about the physical battle. It's a lot about guys on the outside who used to be the fast, nippy wingers are now like man mountains who will be piling the ball back in and trying to create a goal forward in the ruck that helps them play more expansively down when they, you know, when the ball gets into a better part of the field. What we should, hopefully we can get on the Saturday game as well. My favourite player in the NRL is a guy, he's the King of Bradford. He just moved over last year and was a revelation, a guy called John Bateman, who's just, if you've ever heard the Northern phrase, he's all elbows and knees. John Bateman is all elbows and knees. He's got a very distinctive running style. And he's unbelievably strong and just naughty little bastard, always trying to start fights with people, always trying to get into their heads. And he's just pure entertainment. He was actually injured at the start of the season, so he hasn't played. He didn't play the first games before the lockdown. So he's one of the few people who's done well out of this, because he should, fingers crossed, be fit to play this weekend. And if he gets going, he's just an unbelievably... He's just one of these people who just... He's like Lee Griffiths a little bit, like just stuff happens around him all the time. And you never know quite what he's done to wind somebody up, but guaranteed he's done something. And then you look at the Melbourne Storm, who they're going to play against. They've got Cameron Smith, who's just... I mean, what they say in Australia is a future immortal, which is like one above the Hall of Fame. He's one of the greatest players of his generation. He's a bit old now, but he's still going. And he's, I mean, everybody just complains that he refs the game. He's like Scott Brown a little bit. He's constantly onto the ref, constantly getting up the other team. And just, he's one of these, you just think, how do you get away with it week after week? Kind of, he must be what they think Scott Brown's like, you know?
Yeah.
And he'll be number nine behind every play of the ball. He'll be there just telling everybody else where to stand and kick a few goals too when he's at it. So, yeah. And then if you watch the game on Thursday morning, you're going to have Mitchell Moses, who's in naughty little shit, play for the Parramatta Eels, but very exciting player to watch. Blake Ferguson, who's on the wing, he's a baldy bastard. He's just brutal. Plays on the wing like he's a prop forward. He's probably the best winger in the world. And then the other side, you'll have David Fifita, who's just an absolute freak. He's just some of the... Him and there's a guy called Payne Haas, he's only 19 or something as well. And you just think, like, how have you got to be that big, that young? We'll be knocking lumps out of each other. And if that goes well, there's a guy called Anthony Milford, who's a sidestep like you've never seen. And you would hope he'll get... He's a bit hot and cold, but if he's on, he's pretty elusive. So there you go. Write them down. I might put a phone call into the Bynum. I used to do Bynum in rugby league on their rugby league angle. I might see if they want to bring me out of retirement to do the Roosters South game, and then I'll put it on Twitter and you can all join me for it. I'll explain the rules to you.
Right. Well, I see. Do you want to give your Twitter and then people can follow you?
Oh, yeah. So it's Mike Mehol Wood. So that's M-I-K-E, like Mike. Mehol is M-E-H-A-L-L, and then Wood, like Wood. Like, tries to think of a famous word, like
a plank.
He played for... Like a plank, that's what my dad calls me. Like, if you want to know how hard rugby league is, like the former Warrington prop, Paul Wood, who lost a bollock in the grand final and played on.
Goodness.
His missing bollock had a Twitter handle before the end of the game.
Wow. Right, so enough of that. Next time you're on, we're going to talk about the economics of rugby league.
And vis-a-vis Scottish football.
Yeah, and the comparison with Scottish football, because pretty much, take out Celtic and Rangers, and you can map across rugby league and Scottish football.
Indeed, for an early article for Forbes, I have done this, and will have to refresh myself with it ahead of time. But it's, I think, as a teaser, I think if you took out Rangers and Celtic, the average attendance of rugby league across the whole Super League and across the whole SPFL was 400 I think there's 400 more watch Scottish football on average. So they're pretty fucking close. And yet rugby league seems to get certainly much more money out of their branding than Scottish football does.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about that. And with that, Mike, I will say thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Bring me sunshine in your smile.
Thanks for listening to a podcast a wee bit different. Hope you enjoyed it. And Mike will be on again talking about the finances and comparing the finances. Mike writes for Forbes and a number of other places. And he's done some research and done some articles comparing the finances of Scottish football and rugby league. It's really interesting. So he'll be on again soon. Anyway, enough of me. That was Mike Mehol-Wood. With me, Harry Brady, and this is me saying, tune in tomorrow and you can get the final season in the 9-0 Chronicles. Good night and God bless. Good night.
Bring me sunshine in your smile. Bring me laughter all the while in this
this world where we live, there should be more happiness.
So much joy you can give
to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years. Never bring me any tears. Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love, sweet love. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love.